From Wondery, I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams.
And I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And this is Even the Rich. Over the last three episodes, we followed JFK and Jackie through their whirlwind political rise and their tumultuous marriage. We even talked a little bit about Jackie's second life as a successful book editor.
But what we didn't talk about was Jackie's cultural impact. Despite being the first lady for less than one term, she completely changed American fashion.
Absolutely. She's still iconic. I mean, even Kim Kardashian dressed up as her for a cover of Interview magazine.
Yeah, and she wore Jackie's watch when she met with President Trump to plead for Alice Johnson's clemency.
I heard it cost her $400,000 at auction.
Wild. I mean, Jackie Kennedy's style endured for so long that she's still influencing our influencers. So we wanted to take some time to look back on how she became such an important figure in American fashion.
I mean, look, we had to. Tom Fitzgerald and Lorenzo Marquez have been covering political style for years now. So they're joining us today to talk about Jackie's best looks, how fashion works as a language, and why men can get away with such boring suits.
Now, Tom and Lorenzo are the founders and cultural critics behind the fashion blog that bears their names. They're also the authors of two books on celebrity fashion and queer history, and the hosts of the Pop Style Opinion Fest podcast. We can't wait to ask them everything we've ever wanted to know about what it takes to dress like a first lady.
Yeah, like how many pillbox hats do I actually need to own?
And would I look good with bangs like Michelle Obama's?
Buckle up, Richies. This is going to be one hell of a runway.
Hi, Tom and Lorenzo. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thank you for having us.
We're very excited to have you guys today.
Yeah.
Same here.
You know, when we decided to talk about the legacy of political fashion for this interview, you were our very clear first choice. So,
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. It's nice to know. Some people think we're experts.
You are.
Yeah.
So first, can you guys just introduce yourselves to our listeners? Who are Tom and Lorenzo and what do they do?
Okay, I'm Tom Fitzgerald.
And I'm Lorenzo Marquez.
We are a married couple of over 20 years. We've been bloggers since 2006. We're authors of several books and podcasters ourselves. Basically, short answer is that we're cultural critics dealing with fashion, celebrity, and sometimes politics when they all intersect.
So before we really, really get into it, I want to talk about why it's important to talk about fashion. So many people dismiss it as superficial and unimportant. What do you guys say to that?
I'd say that it's important because, first of all, it's part of us. I mean, you can't walk out naked, or at least you shouldn't. So you need fashion. And I think people misunderstand the need of fashion in the sense that I know there's a lot of pressure put into what you wear and what you should and shouldn't wear. Mm-hmm. But it's something that you can use as a tool to express yourself.
Yeah. Also, I think it's important to note, and this is kind of where we've always come in, that fashion has a semiotic and symbolic power to it, especially when you're talking about people in the public eye. But even in your private life, I mean, people dress differently for a first date than they would for a job interview, than they would for, you know, Sunday church. There's power in that. And it's largely invisible in most of our lives. We don't realize how important it is. But whenever we have this conversation about the importance of fashion, we always return to The Devil Wears Prada and that famous speech. Mm-hmm. But we actually know a lot of fashion editors who told us over the years, oh, that speech is dead on. That speech is exactly why fashion is important.
Right. I think fashion can be very intimidating. And there's so much pressure, as I said, to wear certain things. But at the same time, you can use it as a tool to establish who you are, and even better than that, establish who you want people to see you as. And I think you see that with celebrities, you see that with first ladies, you see that
royalty.
With everybody. Right. Mm-hmm. You see them creating a look, creating an image that you can't create without thinking about fashion.
Yeah, for sure.
And speaking of celebrities and first ladies, on your podcast and on your blog, you cover the outfits of celebrities like J-Lo, as well as outfits from political wives like Michelle Obama. Do you bring a different eye or set of standards to celebrity fashion and political fashion?
Oh, absolutely. There's two different goals in mind. A celebrity is selling a product. whether that product is literally themselves or whatever their latest project is. Every red carpet is a marketing exercise, which is why there are corporate logos usually in the background of most red carpets. Yep. But with politicians and female political figures, and that includes people like Kamala Harris or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, as well as people like Michelle Obama, there are just a different set of goals. And it's usually about projecting a certain level of competence and a certain relatability to whoever you feel your constituency is. Mm-hmm. So there's much more of a representational aspect to political dressing, whereas celebrity dressing is purely marketing. So.
Right. I think when it comes to celebrities in general, I mean, the idea is to convince you that you need something, you need that product. And then when it comes to first ladies, I think it's more like, you know, it's trying.
I understand you.
You can trust me. You know, that type of feeling.
Yeah. Okay. So obviously today we're going to be talking about political fashion and in particular, the fashion choices of first ladies. But first, I've got to ask, did political fashion before Jackie even exist? Like, were people talking about Abigail Adams petticoats? Like, I can't think of one influencer in the White House before Jackie.
No, I mean, there were young first ladies prior to Jackie, but not many, and not in living memory of the time when she became first lady. Mm-hmm. We always say that the first lady role is very 19th century, and it's in the way we it's framed and the way we look at it, the expectations of the role. It's very much 19th century socialite. Mm-hmm. So if you look at like grand dames who threw parties and had charities in the 1880s, that's basically what we expect of first ladies. And that has been the case even up to today. That's still the case. Obviously, it has been upended several times over by Jackie, by Nancy Reagan, by Hillary Clinton, by Michelle Obama. But at its heart, it is a very traditional and largely mature, maternal almost sort of role. No, there wasn't that kind of interest in first lady fashion, except in the general, this is how socialites are dressing this season. Right. But even then, like first ladies, pretty much the entire 20th century were all over 50 years old. Several of them were grandmothers or had adult children when they were in the White House. So that's part of why Jackie exploded was because of her youth as well as her, you know, she was chic. She was innately chic. Yeah. Yeah. So, no, not really. There was never that kind of interest in what the first lady was wearing. It was all whether she was, you know, comporting herself correctly and, you know, supporting her husband, supporting the right charities, but not is she wearing the latest hemline or the latest hat. That was never a thing.
Yeah,
it's interesting because we actually had a post about magazine covers with first ladies. And we actually talked about this, the fact that before Jackie, it was pretty much just, you know, good housekeeping and magazines like that, you know, where they're being the wife, there's no pictures or no cover the way we have right now, you know, Vogue.
Glamour covers, fashion covers.
Exactly. Yeah.
So then let's set the stage for 1960 when JFK won the White House. What was going on in fashion at the time?
So the whole post-war era was defined by Parisian fashion, was defined by French fashion. When Dior created the new look in 1945, it just revolutionized mid-20th century fashion, and it was influential for the next 30 years. We were talking about this earlier, and I said to Lorenzo, I said, one way we can frame this is when you look at, say, there's a famous I Love Lucy episode where Lucy and Ethel wear these sack dresses that were supposed to be the latest from Paris, and it was treated as a joke. As something that was glamorous and it was chic, but it was beyond most average American women. Or you look at the 1957 film with Audrey Hepburn, Funny Face, where she plays a model. Fred Astaire is a fashion photographer, and most of it is set in Paris. And again, half the film sort of makes fun of the pretension of Parisian fashion, while at the same time, it sets up Audrey Hepburn as like this flawless avatar of French fashion. So there was like this fascination with it from American female consumer in the post-war era, but it was still largely considered above and beyond what most women were capable of wearing. That's part of why Jackie was so revolutionary, is because she sort of took French fashion away from Audrey Hepburn and basically said, you can dress like this for church on Sunday, which turned it into something middle-class aspirational in a way it hadn't been before. She sort of took all of these French and Frenchified fashion elements and pulled them into, you know, the American living room, basically.
Yeah. Right. I always say that the reason why we're talking about her is because it's she represented all that that idea of beauty and fashion. I mean, she was interested in all these things. She was interested in art.
Music.
She was interested in music.
Yeah.
All these beautiful artistic expressions. And then when you have that kind of life and interest, that is going to be manifested, you know, in the way you dress. I mean, you can't help it. And she adored, like, all the Parisian designers at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was a very smart move. She had this idea that, okay, I'm going to still kind of wear French designer, but I'm just going to make it look like, you know, it's American.
Yeah, American made. Fashion. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you look at Jackie's most popular looks, they really are simple. I mean, she wore a lot of sheath dresses with pearls or two-piece suits with pillbox hats. How did such simple looks become so iconic?
Well, part of the reason is, Lorenzo actually made a really good point. We were talking about this last night, was the kinds of styles, the kinds of French styles that she tended to filter down to her own style were actually fairly easy to replicate because of that simplicity.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of Jackie's very simple styles were very easy for home sewers to replicate. My own grandmother, I can remember in the 1970s, she had several pink Chanel-style suits that she made herself.
You know, it's the type of fashion and style that any woman could wear. I mean, and still do things, you know, like when you wear a shift dress, you can still move your arms around and do things. You know, you're not so restricted as certain fashions of the time.
Yeah. So, you know, one thing I didn't know before we started working on our series was that Jackie's most famous Chanel suit was actually a knockoff. Am I the only person who didn't know that? Like, what's the story?
a lot of people don't know that. And it's so funny. Every time I read about, like, the fake Chanel, I was like, actually, it's not fake. Because, I mean, Chanel sent the fabric.
And the buttons.
And
the
buttons
thread.
And everything. So it was sewn in New York. So you can technically say that it's not made in Paris, but all the elements, all the Chanel parts came, you know, from the atelier in Paris all the way to New York.
Along with the pattern. And they basically just told them how to put it together in America.
So they always crack me up when they say, oh, it's a fake Chanel. Well, yes and no.
Yeah.
I mean, is there a reason she didn't just wear the original?
She was criticized early on for being a little bit too much of a clothes horse and for spending a lot of money. And also, there was some pushback that she wasn't supporting American designers.
Right.
So she actually turned to Diana Vreeland, who was the legendary editor of Vogue at the time, and asked her for some advice as to how to handle this. And Diana Vreeland suggested a bunch of American dressmakers and designers, like Norman Norell was one of them. Mm-hmm. But she eventually settled on Oleg Cassini, who actually was, I believe, a Kennedy family friend.
Mm-hmm.
He knew that he already knew the Kennedys.
And he really understood her style. I mean, you have to remember that in the beginning, she got a lot of bad press because first year, she spent like $45,000 on clothes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, oh, my gosh.
Oh, she was socialite at heart.
When her husband technically was only making like $75,000 as the president. So.
Wow.
Yeah,
seriously.
She was a serious clothes horse. And her immediate predecessor was freaking Mamie Eisenhower. And before that, it was Bess Truman. And before that, it was Eleanor Roosevelt. So to have this like 33-year-old young, glamorous woman come in and just start wearing the latest French fashions and spending a lot of money, people were fascinated. And, you know, we think we live in such a partisan culture now, and we do, but we still lived in a partisan culture back then. And Kennedy's political opponents and political enemies were pointing out how frivolous she was.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You guys just mentioned Bess Truman and some other first ladies. And I'm wondering, do you think that Jackie changed what it meant to be a first lady? Did she create the mold or did she break it?
Both. She broke that sort of 19th century socialite mode, you know, that vision of how she was supposed to look. She was supposed to look like a society grand dame. She was supposed to look middle-aged. She was supposed to look respectable. And here, like I said, here comes this 33-year-old young mother. And not only is she stylish, but she's like an international sophisticate.
Mm-hmm.
It seems really strange to say this now, but for 1960, Jackie Kennedy represented a very exotic first lady. Even though she was white and American, the fact that she was French, the fact that she spoke several languages, the fact that she came from old money, although that wasn't so odd. The fact that she was well-traveled and the fact that she was young. So it just created this version of a first lady that nobody mm-hmm. had truly seen before. And if you look at her immediate successors going down another 20 years, I mean, you can look at Lady Bird and Trish Nixon and Betty Ford and even Rosalind Carter, too, and they all were on some level trying to mimic that sort of old school mm-hmm. Miss Porter, Vassar, pearls and ship dresses and the bubble do. They all had that bubble do right up until Nancy Reagan. And then she came along and changed it into more of a Hollywood thing. But uh-huh. that sort of old school comportment, that sort of finishing school and sort of international sophistication, all of that was something that she injected into the role and that her immediate successors for many years after tried to emulate.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank?
Literally always.
Okay. Well, the new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look, and it comes in luxe gold packaging. It feels incredibly high-end, but it is a lot more affordable.
Oh, yeah. The Panorama Mascara lives up to its name by giving your lashes panoramic volume and a fully fanned-out look. Its tapered mascara wand catches every single lash, including those hard-to-reach corner lashes.
When I do wear makeup, I do the bare minimum, and that's usually eyeliner and mascara and lip gloss.
Yeah.
And so mascara has to really pop.
Yes.
And let me tell you, L'Oreal, this baby pops.
Yeah. I do love the packaging. Like, I'm all about that.
So if you're looking for an affordable mascara that gives you voluminous, lengthened lashes, you can buy the Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
So as a listener of Even the Rich, you know that audio piques the imagination, which is why we're so excited for Audible's new collection of exclusive thrillers. They feature captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances that really bring the story to life.
Oh, yeah. The next listed on my list is the psychological thriller, The Silent Patient.
Ooh.
So it's all about a therapist who tries to unravel the mystery of a woman who refuses to talk or give any explanation as to why she shot her husband. I mean, it's going to be the perfect binge listen, and you know I love my thrillers.
I can agree. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog.
Yeah, new members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500.
That's audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500 to get started. Now, you guys have spoken a lot about fashion as image craft in the past. How adept was Jackie O at crafting her image through fashion versus, say, our last first lady?
Well, the thing is with our last first lady is that she actually was adept at using fashion to send messages, but no one liked the messages she was sending because it was things like, I really don't care, do you? When it came to Jackie, she was adept at it, but it was image craft has changed in the last 60 years. When I look at the way she crafted her clothing, it's in a very sort of basic way. One of the things that's notable about Jackie as a first lady is that she had a tremendous international presence and they used her for that. So she did a lot of traveling in a way that her immediate predecessors did not. And sometimes she went on these trips alone. So there's like a famous picture of them getting off the plane in Bogota, Colombia. And, you know, mm-hmm. Jackie's known for these prim little pillbox hats. And she mm-hmm. has this massive brimmed Latin American style hat on and this bright green coat. And it's little things like that. When she went on her famous trip to India, she wore all of these brilliant pinks and jewel tones and stuff like that that would call to mind Indian fashion or Indian folk elements. So she did it in that way, in very broad strokes is how I would put it, where she do a, you know, no pun intended, a tip of the hat to local ethnic styles or folk styles, or it would come up in what sort of colors she was wearing, that sort of thing.
Yeah, she did it in a very light way. It wasn't like Michelle Obama did. I mean, Michelle was very conscious about who she wore and who she wanted to support. I mean, that's why you have these amazing designers now. Because of Michelle Obama, she wore all these incredible up-and-coming designers, American designers.
She also featured a lot of designers of color, and that was very deliberate.
So I think each first lady had a way to deal with how to present fashion and how to be seen very carefully in a totally different way. So I think Jackie did a phenomenal job, and Michelle Obama is the same. In terms of Melania, I think Melania didn't have that in mind. That's my opinion. I think she just wanted to look good.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And spent a lot of money.
She liked labels.
Yeah, she liked labels. She dressed like a lady with a lot of money, you know, which is fine. That's who she is, who she was. But that wasn't necessarily a message there. I'm wearing these designers because this is the message that I want to give here to the American people.
Right.
But you can look at Jackie's influence in terms of the way she introduced that idea of having meaning in what you wear and when you wear it. I feel like that idea was picked up later by people like Princess Diana, Michelle Obama, also by Kate Middleton. I think you can see Jackie's influence as a public sort of high-class lady. What her public style was like has been filtered down for the next 50 years by a lot of very, very public, high-profile women. I pointed this out to Lorenzo. If you look at Michelle Obama's first White House portrait, the year they went into the White House, she's in a black Michael Kors sort of body skimming dress with it's sleeveless, white pearls and a bubble do. And it is, I mean, it's Jackie to a T. It is. And that's Michelle Obama is clearly, that's not an accident. That was thought through. She knew. And again, it goes back to Jackie in 1960 was considered this sort of exotic, slightly un-American first lady. And, you know, 45 years later, here's Michelle Obama as the first black woman first lady, taking that same sort of idea and taking it even further. Hmm. Now, Michelle's image changed over time. She loosened up a lot as first lady, but her first several years in the role, the press was talking about it at the time, about how much she was taking her page from Jackie.
Okay, so then if I asked you to create a top five list of fashionable first ladies right now on the spot, who would be on it?
I'll go first.
Okay.
But I think I'll speak for both of us. I don't think we... number one, Michelle Obama.
Oh, yeah.
Number two is Jackie. Mm-hmm. Number three is Nancy Reagan.
Okay.
And we did a talk in D.C. like 7 or 8 years ago where someone asked us this question, and I said Nancy Reagan, and the whole room gasped.
I know.
And I was like, look, I you don't have to agree with her politics or anything like that, but there is no denying that Nancy Reagan was, first off, very stylish in a very flashy sort of Hollywood way. And she also changed the role in much, you know, not in the same way that Jackie did, but she did change the role. So that's number three. Oh, God.
I don't think we have a four.
I mean, I would be hard pressed. Hillary Clinton is not known as a fashion icon by any stretch, although the longer she's been in the public eye, she's pretty much an institution at this point. Mm-hmm. We have an understanding of what her style is. What is a Hillary Clinton pantsuit? Everybody knows what that is.
Yeah.
And in the 90s, when she wore those headbands, everybody talked about her headbands. So to say that she wasn't stylish isn't true. And to say that her style didn't have an effect isn't true. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez basically dresses like Hillary Clinton when she goes to work every day.
Yeah.
That is how Hillary has affected political fashion. Yeah. So yeah, I would put her as number four. Yeah. If I really wanted to go out of left field, I would probably say someone like Eleanor Roosevelt, who was frumpy by today's standards, of course. I mean, when you look at 1940s fashion for middle-aged women, we're not talking the cover of Vogue, but she did have high style. It was very much of the rich, cultured, elderly lady style of the time. It was a lot of fur coats and sort of frivolous looking hats, but she did have a style. And the fact that she was in that role for, 16 or 14 years or whatever, and so influential in it, I just think it goes hand in hand. Mm-hmm. Were people dressing like her at the time or taking cues from her style? Probably not. But I think America probably found it very comforting that there was this grandmotherly figure who, you know what I mean? Who looked stable and strong and noble during a time of great tumult, through the Depression and the war. So those are my answers.
You have to look at the time to, you know, to give that kind of answer. You have to understand what they were trying to achieve at the time. I think the most wonderful thing about Jackie is that she was able to keep her fashion sense and style, but tone it down to the American audience. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean, it was genius because she said, okay, I'm going to wear Chanel, but it's not really Chanel. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what, you can even wear the same, you know?
Yeah. You can buy the butter pattern and make this suit. But it's true. Like, we wrote about 1960s style for almost a decade when Mad Men was on the air. We wrote a whole series of posts about it. And we became fairly adept at reading the style of that decade and finding a lot of source material. And I'm telling you, by 1964 or 65, every white woman in America was heading to church on Sunday looking like Jackie. Yeah. That's how influential she was on the middle class. I could say that Michelle Obama had an effect, and she probably did have an effect on Black American women on how they dressed, but it's not the same way. I mean, I don't think anybody had the effect that Jackie had, where you can see women well into the 1970s, middle class. If you look at like photo albums and newspaper clippings and stuff like that, that basic sort of Chanel type suit, usually in a pastel color, with a pencil skirt and some sort of hat, it outlived her for 10 or 15 years on the backs of American women.
Yeah. So now, given you've just mentioned Jackie's enormous influence being possibly greater than Michelle Obama, what makes Michelle number one on the top of your list?
Oh, wow. Well, she was, I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead, but I mean, she had a lot. She had some freedom in what she was able to wear more than Jackie was. So she didn't have to worry about wearing designers who weren't American. It was all first ladies have to make sure they don't overdo that. But Michelle really opened it up to big name brands. So she was wearing Valentino and Gucci and stuff like that to state dinners. Mm-hmm. Jackie's style was, as we said, sort of this filtered down version of French style that she tried to make more palatable to the public. So she simplified it. Whereas Michelle Obama didn't do that. She took what was out there and she crafted an image based on what fashion was producing. And because she was the first Black woman in that role, what she was doing was, I have no problem saying, far more important than any message Jackie had to send. Nothing against Jackie, but she was not a history-making first lady. So that's why Michelle is number one. I think her fashion may stand the test of time. It hasn't been long enough to really test it. But I think in 20 years or so, we're going to look back on Michelle Obama and say, wow, she really was a great dresser.
I think the most wonderful thing about Michelle Obama is that she was aware of who she was and she is, you know, the color of her skin. And she used all of that to her own benefit. In terms of like wearing a ton of prints, not being afraid to wear, you know, bright colors and everything. And I feel that, yes, Jackie had an enormous influence and everything, but still, she was still dressed sort of like, I wouldn't say uptight white lady, but she was still that image of a white lady. And Michelle Obama tried to, I guess she tried to represent everybody, you know, with all these colors and prints and everything.
I think Michelle Obama understood, and I'm sure she has said this, said as much, but she knew that little Black girls were looking at her. This is not something any first lady ever had to think about. Michelle Obama knew little Black girls are looking at me. And as frivolous as this might sound, because there are so many ways to talk about Michelle Obama and what an accomplished and intelligent woman she is. But to a certain extent, she understood that if she served up Black Barbie to little girls in that role, standing in the White House looking as glamorous as a movie star, she knew how much power that had. And that's why her fashion was so much more dazzling in so many ways. She really was very glamorous in a way very few first ladies ever were. And I think she was very aware that, you know, young Black women and little Black girls were looking at her. And if she presented as glamorous and as aspirational a look as possible, she was doing a service to them.
Now, that actually brings me to something that you wrote back in August of 2020 on your website about Michelle. And I'm going to quote it because it's really stuck with me. You said, "Michelle changed our understanding of what a first lady can look like, not just by the fact of her existence, but in how she refused to adhere to traditional FLOTUS style standards, all of which were devised by and for white women, arising out of traditionally white ideas of femininity, comportment, and appropriateness." Can you kind of talk a little bit more about what you meant by that?
Lorenzo's looking at me like, wow, that was pretty good. Did you write that?
wrote that. That's really good.
It was, yeah.
Well, thank you. As we said, the traditional role of first lady, the traditional conception of the role is very like upper class socialite, late 19th century sort of version. That's where it the idea of her comes from. She has no career of her own. She is there to support her husband. And because she is a woman of privilege and means, she is meant to support a string of charities. That has basically been her role for 100 and some odd years now. And Jackie, you know, was part of that. She, as I said, she was old money. She went to all the right schools, and she certainly wasn't the first socialite to be the first lady. So in that respect, she was traditional. Her youth made her different, but she basically came from that background of either upper class white ladies or aspirational middle class ladies who made it to the upper class. Like when you look at Bess Truman or Mamie Eisenhower, they weren't necessarily born wealthy, but they married men who accomplished a great deal and they moved up the social ladder. You look at Eleanor Roosevelt, pure socialite. She was upper class. She married another man who was upper class and they lived like upper class people. So here comes Michelle Obama. And she's fulfilling this role that is either always been filled by white upper class women or by aspirational white middle class women who were trying to appear upper class. And, you know, she's a descendant of slaves. How much should a woman like that buy into that role? Why would she buy into that role? So, again, this is why her approach to style was, even though it owed a lot to people like Jackie Kennedy, especially in the beginning, it was very much pencil skirts and matching sweaters and pearls. But she really opened it up and she started wearing much more glamorous pieces, much showier pieces, the kind of pieces where 25 or 30 years, or like if Hillary Clinton had worn some of the outfits that Michelle Obama wore, it would have been scandalous. If any first lady was wearing Gucci at a state dinner, it probably would have been a big deal. But she was able to sort of break that mold and say, no, this can be a role of high glamour. And you can use that glamour to make some statements about yourself and about your place in that world. But it is that sort of understanding that I am a Black woman who is standing in a role of tremendous power and influence. And because of that, I have a responsibility to make sure that my image is impeccable in a way that I am going to define, not in a way that white people have defined.
I think that's the great thing about Michelle Obama is that she understood. I mean, obviously, the woman is extremely intelligent and talented and so on. But she understood that she had to, fashion had to be part of her life as a first lady. And so how do I use fashion? How do I make fashion a powerful tool for myself and my role? And I think she did a phenomenal job doing that because, again, used a lot of print, bright colors, you know, wasn't afraid to show her shoulders, arms.
She used to wear, she wore metallics. And what first lady wore metallics before, and, you know?
And not only that, I mean, she understood that she had to wear a lot of American designers. And she said, okay, I'll wear American designers, but I'm going to wear the up-and-coming designers. I'm going to help these people become better Americans through fashion. So I think that's phenomenal. That's the most wonderful thing about her in terms of fashion, because I think she understood how much she could do. Because there is this idea, especially with women, that, you know, women in general, sometimes they feel so guilty for their admiration and appreciation of fashion. You know, it's like something that you're not supposed to have. You can either be talented or be obsessed with fashion. And it's so wrong because it puts a type of pressure on women specifically that, you know, it shouldn't be there. I mean, you can achieve anything you want and still look wonderful. Why not? Fashion can be a way to celebrate how wonderful you are, how talented that you are, and how much you achieved, you know?
And again, you can see that in women like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is not a politician's wife. She's an actual politician. Or even Kamala Harris, who we've said before, Kamala is not the most stylish. I mean, she basically dresses like a lawyer. She dresses very professional. She doesn't tend to dress flashy. But I still think both those women, especially Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, possibly because she's a millennial, she really truly understands image craft. And she understands that it's not wrong for her. This is why, you know, she does like lipstick recommendations on when she gets on Instagram. She understands that that is a tool in her arsenal. She's a young woman. She's an attractive woman. She knows people see that. So why not utilize that?
Right. Fashion is a way to connect with people.
It would be easy for some to really make fun of that and put her down for that. But I, as I've said before, how is that any different from some dude rolling up his shirt sleeve and standing on a tractor and pretending he's a farmer when he's a politician? Or those guys, those politicians who pose for like gun magazines or golf magazines. How's that any different? You know, right. It's just right. using certain tools that are at your disposal to project a certain kind of image and to reach out to a certain constituent. So if there are women in politics who are learning that lesson, I think that's really good. I think, strangely enough, even though she's been in politics a really long time, Nancy Pelosi has learned that in the last several years. Her dressing has gotten very, very declarative. I mean, she always dressed well, but she dresses now in a way that produces images. So, you know, there's that image of her walking out the White House in that red Max Mara coat, putting on her sunglasses after she had that meeting with Trump. There's that other image of her in, I think she's in the Situation Room, standing and yelling at Trump, and she's wearing a blue suit. And then there's that image of her ripping up the State of the Union address, and she's wearing a white suit. Like, she, these were all very declarative outfits. She knew the cameras were on her. She knew she had to appear a certain way. And she also knew that social media would go nuts if they saw her. Mm. And it's not a coincidence that these three outfits I named were red, white, and blue.
Oh, yeah.
So, that's powerful stuff.
It really is. More so than I think I've realized before. Same. Kind of diving into this fashion rabbit hole.
So our current First Lady, Jill Biden, is obviously also a former Second Lady. How do you think her new role will affect her style choices?
I think she's actually really stepped up her game. And not just, I mean, like literally in the past 2 months, she stepped up her game. Because when they were on the campaign trail, she was dressing, you know, the way a politician's wife tends to dress. Jill has a very youthful vibe to her. She's got this sort of sporty vibe to her. That sort of underlies her, the way she dresses. And some people read that as too youthful for a woman her age. But the fact of the matter is she's a very active woman of her age, and she's a very youthful woman of her age. And I feel like it's not so much that she's dressing young, is that she's dressing very active and very stylish. So, I never saw her in a pair of pattern tights or booties or a miniskirt before, but there she was stepping off of Air Force One last week. She's really stepped up her game. Her inauguration outfit, it was what she wore that night, not what she wore during the day when they were on the balcony watching the fireworks. And it was this white Gabriella Hearst embroidered dress and then a matching embroidered white coat. And it had all the flowers of all 50 states in it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they all had meaning. And then the flower for Delaware, I think, was over her heart. Like, she suddenly showed this high level understanding of both semiotics and just style. I would imagine she has a stylist now. I don't know who it is, but I can't imagine that she suddenly got this good at wearing stylish clothes.
Right. But I think it's great that she's trying different things. I mean, she, you know, maybe she realized, well, that skirt maybe is not the way to go, but she, you know, you have to try.
Right.
Why not? Why not? She's allowed to.
I think if there's a, you know, every administration comes in and they have an image they want to project. And of course, with the Obamas, it was, we're making history here. But I think with the Bidens, of course, they want to project a certain idea of stability and competence. And I think that comes through in how she's dressing. It's very sort of, it's almost comforting how she dresses. While at the same time, I think she's aware that they have to project a certain image of vitality because people are worried about his age. Yeah.
Right.
So if she's dressing a little young, I feel like that might have something to do with it, is that she's trying to figure out, how do I project this sort of stable, comforting image, while also making sure everyone understands we're up to the job, we're not going anywhere, we're not done. You know what I mean?
right.
And on top of everything else, she has her own career, which again is history making for a first lady. She is not going to stop working. So there's just this very sort of out in the world sense to the way she dresses. Like, she's going out there.
Now, we've talked a little bit about Hillary Clinton. And what I think is interesting about her is that we've gotten to see her as a political wife and then as a politician. And you've already mentioned a little bit about how her style has changed. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit more about that.
Oh, it's so easy. It's so easy. How did it change? She stopped wearing heels. She stopped wearing skirts. She stopped wearing shapewear. That's it in a nutshell. And good for her. I mean, when you look at her time as First Lady, it was very feminine. It was very traditional. She wore a lot of, you know, if you look at her inauguration gowns, they were very fitted gowns with very full skirts. And the minute she was done as First Lady, I mean, I can't remember the last time anyone saw her in a dress where you saw her legs. Right. It became very businesslike. And there was a certain sort of FU sense to it where she was like, I'm done. I am not a politician's wife. I'm a senator now, and I am not dressing that way.
Mm-hmm. She looks way more comfortable now than she looked yeah. when she was.
I agree.
I mean, if you go back and look at the pictures, she looks uncomfortable. She doesn't. She's not happy with the way she looks, and you can clearly see that mm-hmm. she was forced into that position, yeah. as opposed to the other ladies we just talked about. You know, that mm-hmm. sort of learn how to deal with the situation to their advantage. I don't think she ever achieved that.
No, but. I don't think she dislikes fashion, and I don't think she doesn't understand it. Yeah. When she accepted the nomination at the DNC, she came out in a white suit. She understood yeah. that it was a powerful moment, not just because she was paying homage to the suffragettes, which everyone would have understood immediately, but the image of here's your presidential candidate, and they're not in a blue men's suit, which is right. how every presidential candidate has accepted right. the nomination going back 75 years. To come out in that white suit is to say, I am change. So I think she understood fashion. I think she appreciated it. I think she utilizes it, but it is not a priority for her. It never was.
Life is busier than ever. It might be harder to find time these days to grocery shop, prep, and cook healthy and hearty meals. I get it. But Factor's got you covered.
Yeah, so Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, delivered right to your door, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes.
Exactly. And Factor is tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. If you're traveling or still finishing up last week's meals, you can always pause or reschedule deliveries.
I mean, I know I've talked before about how much I love Factor because it's just so easy.
And it doesn't taste like, you know, the microwavable yes. meals you see, especially in rom-coms when we're trying to heighten and highlight how sad and pathetic this woman's life is.
Yeah.
They don't taste like that. They taste so good as if you made them yourself or hired a chef. Head to factormeals.com/rich50 and use code rich50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box. That's code rich50 at factormeals.com/rich50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
We all face stress in our daily lives. What if the answer to a better stress response is in one key nutrient? I'm talking about magnesium, and specifically Magnesium Breakthrough by Optimizers. This one-of-a-kind product is designed to reverse low levels of magnesium, which could have a positive effect on our stress response. But don't take my word for it. Here's a quote from a 2020 issue of the scientific journal Nutrients. Results suggest that stress could increase magnesium loss, causing a deficiency. And in turn, magnesium deficiency could enhance the body's susceptibility to stress, resulting in a magnesium and stress vicious circle. I only recommend Magnesium Breakthrough by Optimizers. It's the only organic full-spectrum magnesium supplement that includes 7 unique forms of magnesium for stress resilience and better sleep. Simply go to bioptimizers.com/ifstories. Promo code IFSTORIES10 to get your magnesium breakthrough and find out this month's gift with purchase. That's bioptimizers.com/IFSTORIES. Promo code IFSTORIES10.
Now, you guys have talked on your podcast about how much more scrutiny female candidates face in their style choices compared to male ones. If you had your way, what standards would you impose on how men in political life dress?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah. It's hard to impose anything because they're always wearing a suit. You know, how much you can change in terms of it. But I think they were a little more adventurous in terms of wearing a three-piece suit with a mm-hmm. different vest or more interesting ties, different shoes.
I mean, President Obama wore a tan suit and the country melted down for a day and a half.
Truly, so, they lost their minds.
I don't know. I love men's fashion. I love to see men trying more fashionable things. But honestly, yeah. once you start letting them wear vests or colored shirts, or if they're allowed to get away from that, you know, blue suit, white shirt, red tie thing, mm-hmm. it starts looking, people freak out a little bit. We're very weird about men and fashion and who's allowed to be fashionable and who isn't. And generally speaking, I don't think the voting public admires a male politician who's putting too much into his look.
Right. But I think they would dress a lot better if they focus on little things like fit, for example.
Fit. Oh, yeah. My God. Donald Trump wore those tents.
Oh, my God.
And then so, his tie was all the way down to his knees.
So, like, fine. You want to wear a black suit or a navy blue, fine. But can you... Can we focus a little bit on how it fits on you?
Well, I'll say Joe Biden's fit is flawless.
Oh, yes, of course.
He is a very fit man himself, and he wears his suits very snug. And again, I feel that that's a little deliberate. If you look at him when he was vice president, it was more or less a standard cut of suit. And if you look at him now, his suits are cut just a little bit tighter to show how much vitality he has. He's got an athletic body. He's in fantastic shape. I mean, he is old, but he is... You know, compared to the last guy, he looks like he could run laps around them. There is that. You can play with things like fit to make sure that people see that you're young, that you're vital, that you're, you know, competent or whatever. But generally speaking, we're not going to see men in politics change their look all that much. I think there's a little bit more room for casualness in politics. I think John Ossoff in Georgia looked unbelievable in a pair of low-slung jeans and a belt. And he played that to the hilt because he knew he looked good in that. And his entire campaign, all he wore was dress shirts, low-slung jeans, and a belt. And when you're young and you're thin and you can and you look great in those outfits, why wouldn't you dress that way? But that's still very limited. I mean, it's like business casual at best. We're just not going to see, no one's going to be wearing flared pants. No one's going to be wearing cropped pants like little Tom Brown skinny suits or anything like that.
There's not going to be any Tom Brown.
No, I mean, it's basic business wear for men, and there is no incentive for any of them to really shake that up.
Okay, so then what should we expect from our second gentleman? It sounds like you're saying not anything exciting.
No, I mean, have you met our second gentleman? And I don't mean
I haven't.
I really like him. I like that he has embraced that role. I have literally no criticisms for the guy whatsoever. But like his wife, he dresses like a lawyer. He's a lawyer and he dresses like one. He's a middle-aged dad and he dresses like one. Nothing wrong with that. That's who you are. I was impressed with his outfit at the inauguration because I could tell it was fine. The coat that he wore was beautiful. He's also, you know, he's a fit man. He looks good in well-cut clothes. But I couldn't name an outfit. Yeah. He's not going to be that guy, and that's fine.
Yeah.
That's all we have for today. This has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
You guys.
Thank you for having us. I'm glad we could work it all out.
Yeah, I feel like I learned so much about style and fashion that I thought I knew and I didn't.
Same.
Fantastic.
Thanks again to Tom and Lorenzo.
Yeah, that was so much fun. I really can't wait to read everything they've ever written about Michelle Obama.
Same.
If you like our show, please give us a 5-star rating and a review. And be sure to tell your friends. I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams.
And I'm Brooke Ziffrin. Our producer is Natalie Shisha. Our associate producer is Kate Young. Our audio engineer is Mark Bush. Our executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Jenny Lauer-Beckman, and Marsha Louie for Wondery.
I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers?
That's a butterfly effect for real.